Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, making music in the age of COVID-19 with Iowa City-based band The Awful Purdies. We'll talk about the challenges of this moment and their new album, The Great Unraveling. But first, an elusive, beautiful, and strange bird, the wood duck. Wood ducks are native to North America, but 100 years ago, it seemed likely that they would go the way of the passenger pigeon. They were hunted relentlessly for their beautiful feathers, and the unique habitat they require was being destroyed quickly. They are one of the great conservation success stories and one of the most beautiful sights to behold if you're lucky enough to see them. Greg Hoke works for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He is the author of the book With Wings Extended, A Leap into the Wood Duck's World, and he is on the line with me now. Hello, Greg.
Hello. Thank you for having me this morning.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Greg. And the term beautiful, the word beautiful, that adjective gets thrown around a lot when we're talking about wood ducks. In fact, a lot of people have called them the most beautiful waterfowl, the most beautiful bird. I mean, they really are an incredibly striking bird. For people who aren't familiar with wood ducks, let's talk about what the male wood duck looks like.
Yeah, so yeah, I found in just all the various historical descriptions over 30, and I found a few since then. When the first sentence of the description of them, they use the very phrase "most beautiful." So they're just incredibly eye catching. I'm looking at a photo right here. So they've got this greenish head, this kind of chestnut chest. Yellow flanks with these really fine vermiculations on them, and then kind of a blue back or a blue black back. One of the other interesting things about them is all those colors I mentioned aren't really in the feathers. So there's two different ways you can have a feather color. It's actually pigments in the feathers. So that's your yellows, your whites, your reds, your browns, and your blacks. The iridescences, the greens and the blues, those are actually structures on the surface of a feather. Much like on a sunny day, if you look at a soap bubble, you see a whole rainbow of colors. That's what you're looking at when you're looking at the green head of a wood duck or a mallard, or just all the and you get that kind of shimmer if you're out, you know, outside and you see one of these birds. It's not just a green head. There's some greens and yellows and purples and blues, and they shimmer every time a feather makes just the smallest movement.
I can imagine, given that they are somewhat reclusive birds, or at least reclusive by our standards, that getting deep into the wilderness and coming across a wood duck, there probably were times when people thought they were seeing a mirage because they are so extraordinary.
Yes, they are. I mean, as far as and actually Charles Darwin, one of his books talked about the idea of sexual selection. And that's how all birds, especially the males, develop these really bright colors and contrasts and the peacock's tail, etc. But one of the most interesting things about the wood duck specific, you just mentioned the wilderness. Literally wood duck, you can find them if you're in the eastern half of the country. They're everywhere. You don't have to, you know, take a three-week drive up to Alaska or go to Antarctica. In many places, they are quite literally in your backyard. The other thing about the color on these guys is if you're out in the, if they're paddling around out in the middle of a pond, they look just shockingly spectacular. But in the name wood duck, they will often sit in trees or the edge of ponds where you've got some branches overhead and you get the kind of the dark shadows of branches and then the bright sunlight. And when you get in that habitat, they can actually be incredibly difficult to see.
That's so interesting. And Greg, we're having a little bit of trouble with our computer connection today, so I'm going to ask you to switch over to your phone if you're okay with that.
Sure.
Hopefully that'll sound just a little bit better. We're having some digital hiccups that make it hard to hear. But Greg, you talk about their kind of camouflage, and I do think that that's really funny to call that camouflage, because they are so brightly colored and they almost look like a child's toy because of the way these colors are put together. But in your book, you actually include pictures of British ships that were painted to dazzle the eye, not to camouflage ships, but to make it hard to see exactly where they are. So you think that the wood duck camouflage is similar to that?
Yeah, well, it's hard to make the one-to-one connection. There's the biology side of it, and then there's kind of the human side of it. I don't know if we can draw a direct connection between wood ducks and British battleships, but we can draw kind of a curved line quite easily. In fact, I've got some books on British naval strategy in World War I and World War II. And the last thing you would expect to see in a book on British naval strategy is mention of the wood ducks, and yet they're there. And the idea that a couple of biologists ran with this is one idea of camouflage is to hide and basically conceal yourself. Another way to camouflage yourself is just to look confusing or look like something else. And so that's what they were trying to do. And I would invite your listeners, just go to Google and do an image search on dazzle camouflage, and they'll pull up hundreds of pictures of battleships and cruisers and even aircraft carriers, that were just painted in these just absolutely bizarre patterns, basically just to try to confuse, whoever's trying to look at and probably then shoot at, the battleship or cruiser.
The male wood duck gets all of the attention for his beauty because, I mean, they are so incredibly striking. But the female wood duck is actually really beautiful, too. And you mentioned the iridescent feathers. That's something that she sports. Let's talk about her a little bit.
Yeah. And so, you know, the old story is, you know, males have to be bright and spectacular looking because they have to attract the females. And females need to be dull and brown looking because they need to be camouflaged when they're sitting on the nest. Some of the biology and evolution on this is there are still some debates. But if you're a mallard nesting out in the prairie, you need to be pretty well concealed. A wood duck nests in a hole in a tree. So you're not just going to accidentally see a wood duck if she's sitting on her nest. Therefore, there weren't quite as many evolutionary pressures to make her look as drab and dull and brown as some of the ground nesting female ducks.
The wood duck, as I mentioned 100 years ago, we didn't think we'd ever see wood ducks. They were hunted almost to the brink of extinction, although it was also about habitat loss as well. But tell me a little bit about hunting practices and how they just decimated this species.
Yeah, so, back before the Migratory Bird Treaty, so pre-1916, when spring hunting was legal, most ducks are going to nest in what we call the prairie pothole region, the duck factory, or further north in Canada. So they had to run a gauntlet of guns every spring and then every fall on their migration. Wood ducks nest across the eastern United States, from Florida and Louisiana up to the Great Lakes, New England, and even into southern Canada. So literally and figuratively, wood ducks were under the gun 12 months out of the year. So between all that hunting, and then on top of that, wood ducks need big trees, big enough to have a cavity in them that they can go into and lay their eggs. We had massive deforestation in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Beavers were also trapped and hunted almost to extinction. Beavers are great for making flooded areas in forests, especially in the east. And then at the same time, one good way to make a hole in a tree is for an ivory-billed woodpecker or a pileated woodpecker to make the hole initially. So we had heavy hunting, massive deforestation, beavers trapped almost to extinction in the eastern U.S., and we all know the story of the ivory-billed going extinct, and back in the day, even the pileated woodpecker was fairly rare. So that was a triple whammy and then some on this particular species of duck.
So they had all of the cards stacked against them. And again, I mean, it wasn't just people hunting wood ducks because they were hunting ducks, but also there was an incredible desire for their feathers, for women's hats, right?
Yeah. So, there's all sorts of stories in the historic literature of people walking down the streets in New York City and counting hundreds and hundreds of birds on women's hats. That was the fashion of the late 1800s. I also bring up in the book another group of people who were really fascinated with wood ducks were people who were really into fly fishing, because there are a lot of flies that you can tie with all the different range of colors and sizes and shapes of wood duck feathers. In fact, I found a couple of quotes, people saying that people who fish may be more familiar with wood ducks than people who are duck hunters.
Because of the beautiful patterns, I assume we can recreate those synthetically these days.
Well, we don't even need to do that. I mean, so wood ducks have gone from the brink of extinction to, in most states, are one of the two or three most heavily harvested duck, at least in the eastern half of the country. So I know I have a number of friends who like to fly fish, and yeah, we harvest hundreds of thousands of wood ducks every year in this country. So there's really no shortage of real actual feathers. So we don't even need to make the artificial or plastic ones.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about wood ducks, a really remarkable and beautiful species. With me right now is Greg Hoke. He is the author of With Wings Extended, A Leap into the Wood Ducks World. And we are going to spend some time talking about baby wood ducks. They do some remarkable things just to survive. We'll find out more in a moment. And then later in the hour, I'll talk with some members of the band, The Awful Purdies, about their new album. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Greg Hoke. He is the author of the book With Wings Extended, A Leap into the Wood Ducks World. And we've been talking about this unusual species. And Greg, let's talk more about where wood ducks nest and how they nest, because that is one of the things that makes this species so unusual. They nest in cavities. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, and this is where we can really bring the story back to Iowa. So for most ducks, they're ground nesting birds. They nest out in the prairies, they're literally on the ground, out in the grass. But there are a few ducks, wood ducks, and a couple others that will nest in tree cavities. And I mentioned earlier that back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, trees big enough to have a cavity that was big enough to hold a wood duck were getting few and far between. So one of the things that biologists were able to do were to construct nest boxes. And most people have probably seen these. In a wildlife area, even a city park, they're roughly 2 feet tall. They're about 10 by 10 inches. And they've got an oval hole near the top. And the way we can bring this back to Iowa and Western Illinois is a couple of the people who really pioneered the use of wood duck boxes was Art Hawkins, who was a student of Aldo Leopold. And then actually one of the names that really comes to prominence early on with the use of wood duck boxes is Frederick Leopold, who obviously lived in the city of Burlington. And Frederick Leopold was able to raise thousands and thousands of wood ducks pretty much just around his yard, as well as in a hunt club, the Crystal Lake Hunt Club, just across the Mississippi River from the city of Burlington. The really cool thing about these nest boxes is they can really engage the public. So I may be really interested in the caribou of Alaska. I can write a check to somebody. That's nice. But there's not much I can do. I can't physically do much to help caribou in Alaska. But I can go out to my garage on the weekend and in probably an hour or two, construct a wood duck box, preferably with a kid or a grandkid or the neighbor kid. Take that out, hang it someplace, and hopefully in another year or two, I will be able to see eggs and eventually ducklings popping out of that wood duck box. And if you want to get somebody, and especially if you want to get a kid hooked on conservation, there's far fewer ways that are better than watching their ducklings pop out of their nest box that they built with a parent or a grandparent or a family friend.
The boxes that Fred Leopold built and that others copied, I mean, that was a little bit of a stroke of luck that it worked so well. Of course, we know that birdhouses of various kinds work for various different species. But I mean, this is really, I think we need to underscore how remarkably well these did work and do work.
Yeah, their design has changed a little bit over the year. The dimensions, they used to be 12 by 12. Now we prefer 10 by 10. There's quite a story on trying to figure out what shape and what size the hole should be. But they work really well. We produce or we can produce quite a few ducks from these nest boxes. Now, the caveat to that story is, millions of wood ducks probably fly south every fall. A few thousand of those probably come from nest boxes. So the strong majority of wood ducks, especially today as our forests are continuing to become more mature, are probably coming from natural cavities. And there's quite a bit of research done in Iowa that demonstrates that fairly well. Our wood duck box is going to increase the fall flight, double or triple it? No. But it is going to add to the fall flight. And then, like I said, that engagement and being able to be actively working in conservation and getting people hooked on conservation, that's probably as valuable today as producing another 10 wood ducklings.
Yeah. So we've got wood ducks nesting in tree cavities or in boxes up high off the ground. And we know that most ducks nest on the ground and incubate their eggs there. And then, the little ducklings get to waddle to the water's edge and follow their mama around. And that's how they grow up. Wood ducklings have to go through something else entirely. And one of my favorite parts of your book was when you quoted all of these naturalists from long ago telling what they believed happened when wood ducks hatched, and they were all completely wrong. So, which just shows how hard it is to imagine what actually happens.
Yeah, and I thought that, yeah, and it's not that they did it wrong, but they did it wrong in so many different ways.
Right. And they all had a different theory.
Yeah, and so whether the box is 4 or 5 feet off the ground or 20, 30 feet, and the research is showing they don't need to be very up at the very, very tops. That actually gets dangerous. You've got to get on ladders and get up there, and probably 4 or 5 feet off the ground is just fine. As an adult, I can easily get to it, or I can put a kid on my shoulders, and the kid can get in there and either look at it or help me clean it out in the spring. The story was that the hen would grab each duckling in her bill, carry the duckling to the local pond, and drop it off, and fly back and forth a dozen times. Then there were stories about the wood duck grasping each duckling in her feet. And then there were stories about she would put the duckling on her back and fly to the nearest pond. As you can imagine, there are basic problems with all of those. What happens is the ducklings just pop out of the hole. In fact, I've got one quote in there for some researchers who actually put a camera in there, and they described it as popcorn popping, with all the ducklings jumping up at the hole, finally getting a toe hold, and then popping out. And it sounds terrible to fall from 20 feet. That would be really painful for us. A duckling weighs essentially nothing, so they can fall from actually quite a distance, hit the ground, bounce once, and they're good to go. It doesn't hurt them at all.
Well, and if they're next to the water's edge, then they get to the water quickly. But if they're not next to the water's edge, they have a long walk after a long fall, right?
Yeah, and even some of the prairie nesting ducks will sometimes nest a half mile. There's even stories of nesting a mile from the nearest water. So you can imagine you're 6 hours old, you weigh essentially nothing, and you got to take a half mile to a mile hike to get to the water. There are also stories of observations of wood ducks supposedly paddling from Burlington, Iowa, over to the Illinois side of the river. And I did the calculations, and back in the day, I was a high school and college swimmer, and even held a couple of records. And I calculated that they used to swim faster than I did, which I kind of hurt my ego a little bit. But once I looked at it, the speed that they can supposedly travel was a little overestimated. But it probably does make sense that, again, a day-old or even hour-old duckling can be born in Burlington, walk down to the Mississippi River, paddle across the Mississippi River, get to the lowlands on the Illinois side before they even get to their first meal.
That is wild. I have so much admiration for these tiny cotton ball sized ducklings. Let's talk about food and what they eat. I mentioned in the first minute of the show today that wood ducks go by many different names, and you can list a few of them for us here, but one of them is the acorn duck. Let's talk about what wood ducks actually eat. What's their diet like?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, ducks live in water, so they eat stuff in the water. There are actually a number of ducks that eat acorns, probably most famously mallards and wood ducks. But there are other species such as gadwalls that also like acorns. Just like acorns are just, they're the super energy food of the natural world. Turkeys, deer, grouse, everybody loves acorns. And wood ducks being wood ducks, they can actually walk very easily on land. Their feet are a little more forward on their bodies than the others, so they can walk and run on land much better than almost any other duck.
So they don't waddle also, quite like other ducks. And you talk a little bit about the evolution that might have led to that, and it might be because of the time that they spend in the trees that they have evolved to have better balance.
Yes. Absolutely. And even the ducks that do eat acorns and similar things, they're eating them on the ground. So they just have to waddle along the ground. Wood ducks will both eat them on the ground as well as go actually up in the trees. And they talk about picking them off. Seems to me easier off the tree branches. Seems to me easier to eat them on the ground, but they will go up in the trees. They'll also eat things like wild grape up in the trees. They're able to exploit a food source that really no other duck or few other ducks are able to get at. And then the rest of the year, they're probably eating mostly things in the water. There's always an interesting balance between are they eating plant material or animal material, i.e. insects and snails.
How do they eat an acorn?
I've had friends tell me, and I've seen in the literature, after they've harvested an acorn in the fall, finding over 50 acorns in their stomachs. So they just gobble them up. swallow them down, and then eventually their gizzard and their stomach will break those down and digest them.
So a shell and all.
There are stories about... there are stories of mallards actually eating so many acorns that they got so heavy they couldn't fly.
Wow. All right. Well, I want to, before we move on from baby wood ducks entirely, I do want to talk about one of the really unique behaviors. Maybe not that unique, but it seems a little surprising to me. And that's nest parasitism. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, and again, a lot of birds do this, and even a lot of ducks do this, where a female will lay an egg in a nest other than hers, with the hopes that another female will incubate her egg for her. And there's a good reason for doing this. I'm actually having somebody else go through the cost of raising my young for me, which seems like a good deal. Early on when we were putting these nest boxes up, if one nest box is good, then two is better and 30 or 40 is better yet. And what researchers found is actually seeing another nest is what stimulates a hen to go drop an egg in that nest. And in fact, some nests had 40, 50 eggs in them. And by the time that happens, then the nest has to be abandoned and all those eggs are wasted.
Wow.
So the management strategy then is when you do want to hang nest boxes up, scatter them out so that no bird can see one box to another.
All right. And, you know, when we think about that behavior of laying your egg in another bird's nest, often we think about it as a cross-species behavior because there are several parasitic birds that only lay their eggs in other birds' nests. But these are wood duck hens who want other wood ducks to raise their young.
They will actually do both. There are a number of records of hooded mergansers are kind of the other famous duck that will use these boxes, at least here in the Midwest. And there are numerous reports of mixed wood duck and hooded merganser clutches. So they will parasitize both other wood duck hens as well as merganser hens.
Fascinating. Well, in your book, I mean, not only do you introduce us to wood ducks and their life cycle and all of the things that we've been talking about this hour, but you have gone through so much conservation literature to pull other people's thoughts about wood ducks. And as we mentioned earlier, some of them are really off base, but it's clear that this is a species that has captured the imagination of many, many conservationists and individuals throughout time. What do you think it is about wood ducks that really just attracts people?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like anybody who writes about a wood duck just somehow instantly becomes a poet. Some of the writing, long paragraphs to just short little sentence fragments, are just stunningly beautiful. So yeah, I don't know what it is about this species, but it pulls the poetry out of anybody who's watching them or writing about them.
Well, Greg, you and I have talked about prairie chickens, and we've also talked about woodcocks. So what was it? This is the third book that has captured your imagination enough to write a book about it. What is your relationship with wood ducks?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I try to find, you know, obviously, you know, animals or birds that, you know, aren't quite on the front covers of all the magazines. But yeah, I was looking around. I had done a grouse, the prairie chicken. I'd done a shorebird, the woodcock, and I was looking around for a duck. And I was like, what's the most interesting duck or the most different duck that has kind of an interesting hook to its story? And kind of wood ducks popped up pretty quickly in that search, and then, as with any sort of writing project, you go down the rabbit hole, and yeah, pretty soon I started talking about writing about or reading about wood ducks, and all of a sudden I found myself in a naval battle between the Germans and the British in 1918. who would have thought?
So they have come back in such a remarkable way. They are a great conservation success story. What about wood ducks today? Do you feel like they are doing well? Are they still under threat?
No, in fact, the wood duck is one of only a couple of birds mentioned in the 1916 Migratory Bird Treaty Act, because basically at that point in time, we were going to write them off just like the passenger pigeon. And now they are one of the most harvested birds in the eastern half of the country. They usually rank two or three in most states. And the overall harvest, they're very high. Today, they probably face their story's changing a little bit. It seems like their nesting habitat's in pretty good shape.
Greg, we are out of time, but people will just have to read more in With Wings Extended by Greg Hoke. This is Talk of Iowa.